joining us right now is Ian Anderson. He's legendary around here and all over the world as the flute player and guitar player and harmonica player and mandolin player and the man behind Jethro Tull. How are you?
I wish I could say I was terrific, but in fact, I came down. I was in America a couple of weeks ago and doing a TV show, and I must have picked up a funny bug then. I got this strange kind of flu thing, and I've not been feeling very well. So I'm getting better. I'm actually feeling pretty good today, but I'm still a little congested and blocked up and not in the best of shape, because I've been in the studio earlier today and have to go back and work later tonight recording a couple of tracks for a German artist. So I'm a little croaky and struggling to do my best.
Well, I
hope I will shake this off in the next couple of days.
You sound good.
Starting this weekend.
You sound okay to me. When I was promoting this interview, I started singing Aqualung.
Listen, you can help me out today.
Yeah, and I was told actually by many of my audience members I should just stick to radio and cut the music out. So, you have a brand new CD coming out. I guess it's already out in Europe, but it's not out here yet. There's a very best of Jethro Tull.
That's correct. It's just literally out now in Europe, and to coincide with this European tour that we're doing next week. It's an album that really was planned about 3 years ago, because we felt, you know, we had all these compilation albums shuttling around for a few years. There were about four or five different Jethro Tull best ofs and compilations that really were designed in the vinyl age, and they weren't really very good value for money in today's terms, because of course back then you could only get about 40-42 minutes on an album, and these days, you know, a CD takes 78 minutes. So we thought we should delete, you know, from the catalog some of these old compilations and replace them with a new single CD with 20 tracks on. And we waited till now because we really wanted to do this remastered, and to get all the old master tapes and remaster them at 24-bit audio. But of course, technology has only really been available in the last year, to see it proven and workable, and there'll be technicians and electronics folks getting used to that technology. Thought let's wait until the Beatles have done their anthology, then we'll do it at Abbey Road once their engineers have got used to the new equipment to play with.
Well, the new stuff.
So
is
it's been a long time waiting for it, but we did this work early in the year, and at the same time we have remastered all the Jethro Tull, or in the process of remastering all the Jethro Tull albums. So in the next 2 years there'll be a gradual changeover to the new remastered versions of all the albums.
What's the big difference that you can hear when you digitize these things?
Well, before, I mean, digital recording technology being 16 bits, which is all that was available from the advent of the CD, it always sounded a little harsh, a little edgy. The dynamic range was a little jagged and, you know, hard little, a jagged curve rather than a smooth curve, you know, in terms of the actual musical dynamics. So particularly obvious in classical music and acoustic music, you know, you could tell things sounded just a little harsh, a little edgy. They I think very fatiguing to listen to for a long time. And that's why a lot of people, of course, prefer vinyl records. You know, they just sound better, they sound bigger and smoother, and that was the case. But of course, when 24-bit technology came along in the last few years, then things could sound a whole lot better. But of course, CDs still only play 16-bit, so to hear the benefit of 24-bit technology, really, we have to wait until the next generation of consumer audio equipment, which will probably be DVD audio, for the audiophile, because I think things will split up into two different areas. My own hunch is that we'll get used to highly compressed audio files like MP3, which will probably be the future for pop music and disposable music, but people who want to keep their music for a long time and want to, rather than just download it from the internet, want to actually own it and have it in their possession and want to hear it sounding absolutely at its best, then I think the DVD audio format is probably going to be the thing.
I'm glad you...
During the next couple of years, that'll start to come along. Of course, Sony and Philips have got their own ideas about the Super CD, essentially the same kind of idea, but just a different format. As usual, Sony decided to do something different to everybody else. I think frankly, they'll yet again they're going to lose the war, and that's my own feeling. But very clever folks at Sony, but they do a little too independent for their own good sometimes. Anyway, but DVD audio, when it comes about, you see, we'll be ready. We'll have all of our albums remastered, and it'll sound terrific. You get some benefit from remastering a 24-bit when it comes to making a CD. However, it does you do actually get a tangible step up the ladder, but it's not as good as replay in a 24-bit medium. See, I have 24-bit audio in my studio now, so at a professional end, you know, I can hear the benefit already recording this afternoon. You know, I was, playing the flute and singing, and it, you know, it sounds just like analog tape, which I'm used to working with, and I'm very pleased with the new 24-bit.
I'm glad you mentioned MP3 and the internet, because I wanted to ask your opinion on the whole thing with the Napster and all these things that are going on in terms of trading files. What do you think, as a person who has a lot of his own music out there, about the internet itself?
Well, it's, you know, the internet has been talked up and made into something rather greater and grander than it really is over the last few years. It's, we've all seen the rise and fall of internet stocks and the dot-com companies that have been announced with such fanfare, only to come crashing a few months later when they just failed to turn into really viable business propositions. And, you know, dear old Amazon.com is the market leader, really, in terms of a business that is exceptionally well run. It provides an exceptionally good service. Absolutely first-rate company, still losing a lot of money, and no sign of an operating profit yet, which is pretty scary for everybody else. I think it's a worrying scenario, because this is like some great lumbering flightless bird, you know, that's flapping its wings trying to get into the air, and it just can't get off the ground. it's sort of funny in a way.
You know,
internet music, of course, is sold via the internet is a tiny fraction of music sold annually. And give you an example, when Jethro Tull's last album, JTull.com, was released, after a week or two, we were the number three or fourth highest selling act in terms of internet sales. You know, we were, right across America, all genres of music and all artists, we were right up there as one of the very, very highest selling. You know, you would think that was terrific.
Mm-hmm.
And to give you an idea, in that week when we were the third biggest selling internet record on the, in the USA, we sold just under 2,000 copies via the internet.
Hmm.
So it gives you an idea of the perspective we're talking about here. You know, it's just a tiny, minuscule little fraction of total record sales are actually via the internet, and that's mail order. You know, I mean, in terms of download sales, it's even tinier, because most acts are not represented. I mean, major acts are not downloadable, other than for promotional purposes. Many of us will do that. You know, we will make available material streaming, you know, to be listened to once, but not downloadable. And that is downloadable is there for promotional purposes, and very limited, usually to just a song or whatever, so people get the flavor of the album. In terms of paying for downloads, it's just an absolutely microscopic little percentage of the total.
Very tight.
And that's not going to change very quickly. You know, it's I really don't think there are any great changes on the horizon in terms of that the economy really shifting to favor the idea of real meaningful levels of trade and commerce through downloading music. But it will happen. It's just probably 5 years away. And even then, I still feel most of us are born lazy. You know, when audio cassettes came about, and the record company folks all got in a fearful flap, thinking, oh, this is the end of records, because people are just going to buy one record, and then they're all going to copy it onto compact cassette and give it to their friends, and it'll be the end of the record industry. No one will have to buy records anymore. They'll just record it, you know, somebody else's record. Well, that didn't happen. You know, what happened was people, you know, had a cassette recorder, and they might make record a few tracks to play in their car or something, but, you know, it's just a pain in the arse, isn't it? It takes a long time, and, you know, it's labor-intensive. So I don't think that's going to happen. I just don't feel that people really have the stomach for sitting there and, you know, going through the hassle of downloading a song here and a song there and compiling an album from the internet and waiting for it to download, which takes really a long time. And if we're talking 24-bit audio, we're talking, you know, really good quality music as opposed to highly compressed audio files of very limited, you know, audio fidelity. Then, you know, we are talking substantial music files. You know, we're talking serious amounts to, you know, a CD is 650 megabytes. You know, if we go to 24-bit audio of the same length, you know, you double that in terms of your actual file size. So you're talking, you know, gigabyte and a quarter. And that, you know, that used to be the whole hard disk on your computer 3 or 4 years
right,
ago.
That's right.
You know, that was a sum total of everything on your computer, and that does not squirt down the internet that quickly. So, you know, I just have this feeling that although it is there in the future somewhere, and it will represent part of the consumption and the paid consumption of music, I don't see it, you know, taking. I don't see it removing the sale of records and music in the more traditional marketplace where people actually purchase something with them, they take it home with them, and they, you know, it's something tangible and real they can have in their hands.
I agree
think that
with
will
you.
Still remain, yeah. You know, substantially a part of the way people will buy music.
I think that people are used to downloading for nothing, and they're not going to pay for it anyway. But I want to get into something else that I thought was really interesting in this very best compilation. Some of the best Jethro Tull songs are long, they're extended, and they have some great instrumentals in it. And it must have killed you, because all your songs are like babies, to have to trim songs like Too Old to Rock and Roll and Minstrel and Heavy Horses for this CD.
That's right. I mean, those are the three songs that got edited. And it was a difficult job because, you know, they weren't alone amongst being Jethro Tull, amongst the Jethro Tull tracks that last, you know, 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 or more minutes. You know, there's quite a few of them. And some of those songs are amongst our best work and perhaps most illustrative of a particular part of our career. So, you know, we didn't want to have to do a lot of editing. You know, I really struggled with this idea and felt that, well, you know, those were important songs to have on the album, and the compromise had to be made, but there were equally other songs that I would have loved to have on the album and would have had to have seriously edited to get on the record that I just wasn't prepared to do that, and felt, no, they're better off not on the record than to be too savagely pruned. But I think, you know, what we did is we tried to get the essence of those songs in the sections that we did keep for the edited parts that are on the record. But, you know, again, I would have been distressed if I'd done that with, you know, more than three songs. Three songs is already three songs too many to have to edit. But
yeah, I know that
any more than three would have started to get, you know, under my skin, certainly.
I'm talking with Ian Anderson from Jethro Tull. I know there's a lot of songs that didn't get on there that are some of your favorites that might be a little bit more obscure to some people. But I want to know a little bit about the little reversal of that. You know, you guys had a lot of hit songs. Were there any songs that you guys had hits with that you really weren't thrilled with the song, but you were happy that it had such great success?
There are some that I didn't used to like that I like a bit better now. I mean, the song Living in the Past, which was Jethro Tull's first real big single success in the UK, you know, I wasn't really wild about that song. You know, I sort of only wrote the song as a bit of a joke when my manager said, write a hit single. You know, I kind of came up with this song that I thought was the opposite of commercial, you know. I mean, I was very surprised that it was successful. I mean, I was very pleased that it was successful, but
sure.
I didn't think it was a great song. And for years and years, we never played it. I mean, in fact, I mean, really for years and years, it was something like 17 or 18 years before we ever played that in
wow.
public. And, you know, I've played it a lot since then, and I, you know, I quite like it now. I have a greater preference for... perhaps the slightly different arrangement that we do on stage, maybe over the original recorded version, but you know, I quite like the song. It's grown on me over the years, but I wasn't wild about it to begin with. And you know, there are other songs. I mean, I guess probably the one that I least like that most people in America do like is a song called Teacher, which is one that I really just don't care for very much at all. There are other songs like Hymn 43 on the Aqualung album. You know, again, I just somehow don't like that. It's not to me, is not the essence of Jethro Tull. It sounds, I don't know, it's, I just don't, the musicality doesn't appeal to me.
For all the fans out there, you know, I didn't know this, but again, there was a possibility of this group actually be called Jethro Toe at one point.
Well, yes, we're never really quite sure whether that was intentional or an accident. It was a, before Jethro Tull was actually Jethro Tull, in fact, it was different members, different people altogether who had been down to, there's a John Evan band, effectively, who went into MGM Studios in London to do a few demos for a producer called Derek Lawrence. And later, before Jethro Tull, but with the same four guys who became Jethro Tull in 1968, a few months before we got the name Jethro Tull, we also had gone in with that lineup to do a couple of demos for Derek Lawrence, and they were subsequently released as a single after Jethro Tull had become known and was getting some attention at the Marquee Club in London. And Derek Lawrence then decided to put the single out on MGM, and he called it, it was said on the label, Jethro Toe. And we just thought at the time that it was a typo, it was just a spelling mistake, you know. But somebody said, no, I think he did that on purpose because he didn't have your permission to release the record, and he deliberately misspelled it Jethro Toe in an attempt to avoid any litigation or whatever.
That's
now,
right.
I don't know the truth because I never saw Derek Lawrence again after that, but it didn't sell very many copies, and even today, you know, at record fairs, you know, people will spend... That's quite a, you know, maybe $100 or something. I don't know what it costs to buy a Jethro Tull record. You know,
I was going to say it must be a collector's edition.
They do crop up at record collector fairs, you know, quite regularly. If somebody wanted one, they would find one. They would just have to pay for it.
We've had most of the big acts of the late 60s on this show, and I don't know if it's my age or what, but I've always felt that the late 60s to the mid 70s were some of the best music that was ever played, and I still feel that the stuff today pales in comparison. Is it my age, or is it the way the music is?
Well, you know, we were very fortunate back then, both as musicians and as listeners, you know, to be there at a time when pop and rock music was suddenly infused with this tremendous, you know, tremendous rich array of musical influences and styles that came into pop and rock music really through a generation of people who were just lucky to be there, and the fact that things had not been done before, you know, it was kind of easy to find stuff. It was easy to find stuff that hadn't been done. You know, just as you know, you could look around at classical music and folk music and Eastern music and Indian music and Mediterranean music and Arab music, and you could take a little of this and a little of that and put all these wonderful things in and come up with stuff that was really exciting and different. You know, it hadn't been done before. Mm. And it was easy because there was plenty out there to choose from. It's not so easy now for a young musician to find some new unturned stone when it comes to getting some new musical influence. It's you know, pretty much everything that can be done with the 12 notes of the musical scale seems to have been done. And, you know, lyrically, not a lot changes. There's a very limited vocabulary in the lyric writing for pop and rock music. So, you know, I guess we sort of, you know, we were very privileged, really, in that time to hear all this stuff happening for the first time. You know, when Jimi Hendrix came on the scene playing guitar the way he did, and Eric Clapton and a few others who had come immediately before him, you know, had sort of laid down a gauntlet. Jimi Hendrix, you know, responded with this, you know, incredible expression and verve and enthusiasm and, you know, sexuality with his instrument. You know, all of these things were tremendously exciting, but there's little point in somebody doing that now. You know, it's already been done, and it's almost like, you know, if Jimi Hendrix didn't do it on the guitar and Eric Clapton didn't do it on the guitar, well, the chances are it probably can't be done. You know? Yeah. You toss in a few Joe Satrianis and Steve Vais and people like that, I think we've pretty much got guitar covered there. I don't think a century from now we're going to hear somebody doing something with a guitar and say, oh, wow, hey, that's different. Never heard that before.
You know, there weren't too many.
It's pretty much been signed and sealed. You know, that particular the evolution of rock guitar is, I dare I say, probably complete.
I'm glad you mentioned the instrument and guitar, because as you are the example of flute. When I mention to people who play flute, they go, "I like to play like Ian Anderson."
The reason I don't play like Eric Clapton is because I realized that very quickly when I first heard Eric Clapton, it was time to make a switch. I laid down my guitar and tried to find something else to do that I could be, a big fish in a small pool, you know, rather than be a fading sort of third or fourth rate version of Clapton or Hendrix or whoever. So, I saw the writing on the wall. As soon as those guys came on the scene, it was time for me to look for something else to do, and I did.
Was it an unusual instrument at the time? I mean, not many people play it. I mean, I know you're mentioning that it was a small pool. It obviously is. Where did you learn how to play flute?
I took what I was trying to do when I tried to copy Eric Clapton. I took those sort of musical motifs and ideas, and I tried to translate those into the flute. But, you know, I picked up the flute towards the end of 1967, I was 20 years old, and I just, I didn't have an instruction book or any help or any lessons or anything. You know, I just had to try and figure out for myself where you put your fingers and how you blew it and how you worked it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a beautifully ergonomically designed instrument. It kind of tells you what to do in a way. But I still, you know, not having lessons, I still learnt in such a way that I committed a lot of cardinal sins, you know, in terms of conventional flute playing. I did things a different way and kind of made up some of my own fingerings and to the way to produce notes. And whilst it suited my music, it did cause me, after about 15 years, to get a little frustrated and felt that I'd come to a dead end. So I actually ended up in the early 90s not taking lessons, but, you know, sitting down and reading a book about playing the flute and kind of learning a little bit more how to do it conventionally. So since then, I relearned the instrument perhaps in more of a flutey kind of a way, whereas originally I had used it almost like a substitute guitar. Mm. I mean, I did with my flute what I couldn't do with a guitar. But I guess I sort of became the Jimi Hendrix of the flute, if you see what I mean.
Absolutely did. In fact, Jethro Tull, that, you know, you can't think of it without the flute, you know? It was a key integral part of all the songs.
Well, that's right, and it's a fun instrument to play. It's just a very frustrating one. And the reason I think it's never been very successful in other people's hands is because it is tricky to make it work in the context of loud rock music. You know, it's an acoustic instrument, it's an orchestral instrument, a folk instrument. It doesn't really work very well in loud rock music, and I guess other people who've tried to do it, you know, gave up from frustration. In my case, I just plugged away at it and, you know, learn to play it a bit louder. But, obviously I'm very careful about the way that I amplify it and the way I use a microphone, you know, whether it's playing into a regular microphone or whether I use a little radio microphone clipped onto the top of the flute. You know, I kind of learned to make the best of a bad job. And you know, most people can hear what I'm playing. Even I can hear what I'm playing on a good night.
Well, you guys have sold 60 million albums already worldwide. And this one over here, the very best of Jethro Tull from EMI, is going to do it even more. I assume you're working on, you just mentioned you were in the studio today, but it sounded like with somebody else. Are you doing any more new Jethro Tull stuff?
Yeah, well, I've written quite a lot of music. I've probably got an album worth of music just sitting, kind of just little musical noodles and doodles on a mini disc somewhere. But it's a disparate bunch of musical material. It's in that early, you know, it's a sketch pad. And, I want to work a little more for the next 3 or 4 months while I'm on tour in Europe and in America this summer, to sitting in all the dressing rooms and hotels that I do. You know, it gives me an opportunity to, you know, probably double the amount of material that I have to hand, so that when we start working in the studio later this year to start recording, then, I shall have more material to choose from and, choose the right kind of stuff that makes sense according to the kind of record we want to make. And I'm not sure what that is yet. It's just at this stage I have a you know, two or three different kinds of music that I'm sort of working on, really. You know, some of it is more arranged, you know, rock band kind of music. Some of it's more, a bit more almost classically influenced. Some of it's more kind of folky influenced. But, I just have to pull it all together and steer it into a more cohesive direction. And that's what I look forward to doing in all those endless hours that I should be sitting in CD dressing rooms for the next few months.
I was going
to
mention that.
Give me something to do.
Exactly. All you folks who are listening at PMPnetwork.com all over the world, they will be everywhere. The tour is from Europe from May to July, then mid-July through September in the United States. Scandinavia comes September and October, and then 16 dates in the UK and Ireland in November, December 2001. You are going to be a very busy man.
Well, you know, it's nice to keep busy. We've always been busy. We're always out doing concerts. That's what we like. And, you know, doing tours is a little bit of an adventure. We get to travel lots of interesting places, meet lots of interesting people, and see lots of interesting sights. So it's a little bit like planning a big vacation and getting paid for it. You know, what better way to make a living?
Now, are you married or single, or have you been married? Any kids?
No, I am married. I've been married for 25 years, and I have two children. And
either one musically inclined?
A couple of dogs and stuff.
Any either of them musically inclined?
Well, my son's actually got a concert tonight in Cambridge, playing drums. He's a drummer. He plays a few other instruments as well. He just graduated from university last year, so he's trying his hand at developing his musical career before he gets a proper job. I can remember doing the same thing.
Well, and then look at you, stuck with it though. You know?
Well, that's right, and it's you know, it's also about getting lucky breaks as well. So he may not be as lucky as me. He may have to end up washing dishes or I guess he'll probably do something connected with the music business, because that's not only what he knows, but also what he was studying at college. So he was, doing television and film, you know.
It's in his blood,
music oriented media and stuff. So I guess he'll be looking for work in that kind of line of endeavor.
I don't want to keep you all day because I know you're not feeling well, but you mentioned you had a lucky break. What was your big lucky break?
Well, I think my big lucky break was just being there at a time when, you just had to come up with something halfway interesting and different, and people would sit up and listen. You know, I just guess that people back then were, more excited, more interested in what was happening. I think these days, it's a pretty heavy sell. These days, in order to get people's attention, you have to work 10 times as hard. So, I don't listen to a lot of contemporary pop and rock music. It doesn't interest me. It didn't interest me back then. You know, when I was a teenager, I didn't listen to pop music either. I listened to, I listened to Muddy Waters and Sonny Boy Williamson, and I listened to jazz and blues when I was a teenager. I didn't really pay much attention to pop music at all. But I have a lot of sympathy for folks who are trying to become successful now. It just seems to me a whole lot harder, and you have to work even harder, and you really have to package and merchandise and promote and market in a mercilessly industrial way. And thank goodness I was lucky enough to be back then at a time when, you just played what you enjoyed, and it was fun, and people listened to it, and they were excited, and there was a ready response. It just seemed so much easier back then.
Well, I still have my copies of Aqualung and Thick as a Brick and all these other ones, and I grew up with the music that you play, and I look forward to more and more music coming out, and the very best of Jethro Tull coming over to the shores here, and I look forward to more new music from you as well, so from that that tour you do. I'm sure something's going to be written that's going to be pretty good to listen to.
Well, I certainly hope so, and we also have the chance to try some ideas out on stage as well, which is another good thing about being on tour.
Mm.
So, that's always a good time. At least you have all the guys around and the musical instruments. You have apart from doing a concert every night, you've got access to the tools of your trade. That's very important.
Well,
anyway,
folks can check out JethroTull.com for the tour dates and all the information. And,
well, it's JTull.com.
Is it JTull?
Yeah.
Ah,
J-Tull.com.
Ah. Ah.
If you're at JethroTull.com, you still end up with this is still under dispute. You see the guy who owns the JethroTull.com name, who actually lost it in a dispute last year, is still a legal thing, legal wrangle going on. But I'm sure we'll get the name back. It's just unfortunate that in the meantime, JethroTull.com takes you to a hard porn site.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That's really the reason that I went after this guy, because I didn't like the idea of JethroTull.com being an access to a hardcore porn site, because, you know, a lot of little kids learning to play the flute, you know, that I come across and they write to me asking for advice and help. You know, it's all too easy for folks like that to think, I'll take a look at JethroTull.com, see what's there. But, of course, that's why this guy had JethroTull.com. He also has PaulMcCartney.com, MickJagger.com, RodStewart.com. He went after a whole bunch of .coms a couple of years back. He was paying attention. The rest of us were all asleep. He jumped in there and he got the names. And that is not a problem. You know, that I my hat is off to him. You know, he was entrepreneurial in the spirit of the Wild West. He went out there and took, planted his flag and took the land from the Indians. But basically, you know, where I got cross was when he started using it as a gateway to a porn site. That's when I thought, got to call the lawyer.
J-Tull.com. Mm, all right, we'll make sure we link that up. We'll put a link to it with your interview.
Marvelous. And, good to talk to you.
You too. I hope you feel better soon.
Well, thanks very much.
Take care.
Thanks. Bye-bye.